It's Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Galley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. More than 1,000 people have sued the state, alleging they were abused at a government-run youth detention facility. The first civil trial against the state for those alleged abuses at the former Youth Development Center in Manchester began this week. Jason Moon has been in the courtroom following this case, and he joins us now. Good morning, Jason.
Hey, Rick.
Jason, you've reported this trial is significant because it is the first time one of the hundreds of alleged victims is taking their case to court. So what's the jury's role here?
Yeah, well, they're going to have to decide whether the state of New Hampshire itself was responsible for the abuse that David Mia and the plaintiff says he suffered while at YDC in the 1990s. So as you said, this trial is against the state of New Hampshire. So they're the defendant in this civil trial. And Meehan's case is basically that the state was negligent, that they ran the facilities so poorly, they ignored so many red flags that they bear responsibility for the abuse he says he suffered. And so it's going to be up to the jury to decide whether he's right.
Now, two former staff at the Youth Development Center testified in court this week. What did you hear from them, Jason?
They described a fairly chilling environment and culture at YDC in the 1990s. We heard, as of yesterday, three former staffers. One, Karen Lemoyne, worked at YDC in the early 90s. She saw signs of what she thought might be child abuse happening at YDC. She says she took them to management on multiple occasions, was brushed off, dismissed, even had a complaint form she'd filled out, according to her, crumpled up and thrown back in her face by a supervisor at YDC. And she says eventually other staff began to see her as a troublemaker. They iced her out. They called her a rat for bringing these complaints to management. Another former staffer we heard from, Wayne Eigebrot, he was actually in charge of or worked in training at YDC and for a time was in charge of internal investigations there. He described a culture where a few, if any, staff would actually attend the trainings he was trying to put on for them, and a culture where both the staff and management didn't feel like they needed any trainings. He also described an episode where he says he conducted an internal investigation into use of force by a staffer at YDC, found that it was substantiated, that a staffer had used excessive force on a child. And this witness said he recommended that this staffer be terminated and possibly prosecuted for this action. And then he says he later found out that that employee had been promoted. We also heard from that witness's boss, Virgil Bossom, who described many of the same things in terms of the culture around training and resistance to any kind of independent or external investigations into YDC. So that's been what we've been hearing so far from former staff.
Yeah, chilling testimony there. Who's representing the state and what's their defense?
Well, you have attorneys from the Attorney General's office, the Civil Division, representing the state in this trial. And, you know, so far through cross-examination, they have been planting seeds of doubt throughout the testimony of these witnesses, suggesting that maybe in certain areas they are embellishing the testimony to sort of line up with the plaintiff's narrative or maybe suggesting that their testimony is motivated by a dispute they had with another employee at YDC going back to the 1990s. But most interestingly, what happened yesterday was the first time they actually began to raise doubts about the underlying allegations of abuse that David Meehan is bringing. So the state of New Hampshire was, you know, pointing out during a witness's testimony that the plaintiff, David Meehan, never complained of sexual abuse while he was at YDC. And it's interesting and significant because, as we've talked about before, the state of New Hampshire in separate criminal proceedings is prosecuting those people, those individual guards that Meehan says abused him. So here they are in the civil trial raising doubts about whether that abuse actually occurred when, you know, presumably several months from now, when these criminal prosecutions begin, the state is going to be saying that happened, and they're most likely going to be using David Meehan as a witness. So we're starting to get into that territory where the state is arguing one thing in this civil proceeding that may end up working against them in the criminal trials that are still to come.
Sure. It's a strange place for the state to be in, I imagine. So how are you continuing to follow this case, Jason, and other news out of the YDC lawsuits against the state?
Yeah, so we'll just be continuing to follow this trial. It's likely to last at least a couple more weeks. And, David Meehan is expected to testify himself at some point during this trial. That'll be a very interesting day. And we'll see what kind of witnesses the state puts on. And when they make a more affirmative defense in their half of this. So we'll see what happens with the case and we'll follow it as it unfolds.
And HPR's Jason Moon. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks for your time and for sharing your reporting with us. You can find more of Jason's work, by the way, at nhpr.org. New Hampshire Congresswoman Annie Custer recently announced that she is not running for re-election, and candidates are already stepping into the race for the 2nd Congressional District seat. NHPR's Josh Rogers joins us now to get some analysis on that. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Rick.
So what do we know, Josh, about Congresswoman Custer's decision not to run again?
Well, we know it wasn't entirely expected, but maybe also not shocking. Custer has served 6 terms, which is the longest tenure of anybody who's ever represented New Hampshire's 2nd District. She's deep into her 60s. She was one of the members of Congress who was under direct physical threat during the January 6th storming of the Capitol. And frankly, she would say she was a bit traumatized by it. She would certainly be in a strong position for re-election had she decided to go that way. And, a very strong fundraiser. But service in Congress, regardless of party, is a pretty grim reality these days. And Custer's told me when I interviewed her that she expects to spend her remaining time helping to get Democrats elected nationally. And she's already gotten involved here by picking former executive counselor Colin Van Ostern, a former campaign staffer of hers way back when, as her successor.
Yeah. Now, what do you think about that? What do you think about Custer's endorsement of Van Ostern? What does it mean? Does it really have a lot of weight?
It certainly doesn't hurt. I'm not sure it has all that much weight ultimately. This is Colin Van Ostern is a guy who's well known to Democratic operatives and Democratic activists in the state. He's a guy who knows what it takes to win a campaign. He worked as a political operative and in business in the state. It certainly his track record cuts both ways. He was a 2016 Democratic nominee for governor, lost narrowly to Chris Sununu. You may recall he challenged Bill Gardner for Secretary of State in 2018, lost narrowly there. Those are two tough guys to run against. But it's been a while since he's run, and there are people in the party who like him. There are people in the party who don't. He's definitely a plotter and kind of a grinder, which may be what getting elected to Congress takes. I've talked to some Democrats who, will tell you they're put off by Custer's quick endorsement mm-hmm. of him. And, there's certainly some women I've talked to who said that they would prefer Custer through her support behind a woman. But, it's hard to find people who in the Democratic Party who would necessarily be put off by the substance of Van Ostern's politics. But, we'll see. He's rolled out endorsements and he's raised mm-hmm. money, but he's not likely to have this this primary to himself. This is a seat that really plenty of plausible Democrats, if you can get through the primary, a decent candidate would stand a good chance of winning this seat. So, yeah. We're a long ways off, even though, he's clearly been seemingly like planning a run for some time.
Right.
He's rolled out hundreds of endorsements. He's raised money. But there are likely to be other Democrats in the race.
Well, let's talk about some others that have declared the candidacy so far in both Republican and Democratic sense.
Well, he's the lone Democrat who's officially declared his candidacy. Hopkinton State Senator Becky Whitley, who's assistant Democratic leader in the Senate in her second term in Concord. She said she's exploring a run. Seems pretty likely that will happen. She could be a viable nominee, a strong nominee, should she get it. But, running for Congress is different than running in what amounts to a gerrymandered state Senate seat. Dan Feltes learned that when he ran for governor. Colin Van Ostern learned that when he ran for governor. You've got to appeal to a broader swath of people. CD2 does lean Democrat. Becky Whitley could be a strong candidate. She does have progressive credentials based on her record at the State House. Another name that people are talking about and who is making calls or who at least has made calls to people exploring a run is Maggie Goodlander, U.S. Department of Justice lawyer, grew up in Nashua, a member of the Tamposi family. I'm not sure That means a lot to folks these days. You know, Goodlander's married to Joe Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan. She has a very serious D.C. resume, worked for U.S. senators, mm-hmm. been law clerk for justices. Smart Democrats have told me they believe she could raise lots of money from national Democrats fast, but it's hard to know how somebody like that goes over with voters. That's not necessarily the kind of resume that voters these days pine for,
right.
And you just don't know until you get out there whether or not you have what it takes. You know, she does own a house in Portsmouth, which isn't even in CD2, but you don't have to live in the district. You know, there may be others getting in this race on the Democratic side. You know, this is, you know, to reiterate, a district that Democrats, you know, on paper should be able to hold. So,
right.
You know, that could drive more people to get into this race. And on the Republican side, you know, Vikram Mancharamani, who ran in 2022 for U.S. Senate, he finished fourth in the primary. He's an author, a businessman. He was a lecturer at Harvard and Yale. He's gotten into the race. You know, Bob Burns, a nominee in the Republican side, has decided not to run. George Hansel, who ran and came in second in the primary, is looking at it. And Lily Tang Williams, who also ran and came in third in the primary last time, has been running for some time. She's from Ware and sort of more liberty-minded Republican,
yeah.
Running largely on her biography of having moved from China and the dangers of communism. So,
well, Josh, yeah, I'm going to have to ask you to leave it there. There's a lot to be watching.
Okay.
City race.
Get back to it.
Yeah, we'll definitely get back to it. I do want to turn our attention to something else that happened in northern New England this week, the total eclipse of the sun.
Having seen 65% in New Jersey in 2017, it was pretty awesome. It was cool. And everybody says it'll change your life when you see a full total eclipse. So I guess I need my life changed.
The ring of fire.
The ring of fire. The fact that there's going to be a giant solid rock blocking out the sun is just mind-blowing. Like, my dad saw a partial eclipse when I was only two, and ever since we've just been wanting to come out here to see it personally.
I feel like I'm in awe. I'm in awe of nature and, you know, the various things that happen in nature. I mean, it's incredible.
Astronomy, right?
Astronomy.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I was not that eager to do this.
No, he wasn't.
But she kept me going, and now that I'm here, I think it's great. Yeah.
It was so surreal, leading like that last second before totality and then just the darkness. And I did feel the wind go down a little bit, definitely calm. And everyone's reaction was amazing because like, there's that pause of everyone just taking it all in.
That was the coolest thing I've ever experienced in my life. Absolutely worth every penny, every moment, every hour on the highway. It was amazing.
The voices of those reacting to a total solar eclipse in northern New England, a once-in-a-generation event. My thanks to NHPR's Josh Rogers and Jason Moon. I'm Rick Ganley. This is Morning Edition on NHPR.